they say that the first 5 to 7 years of your life are the most important. That's when your brain is developing the fastest, and that kind of sets you up for the rest of your adult life. Often when parents are thinking about like where they're going to put their money, like if they have a child and they're thinking, let's save all this money to put them in a really good private high school. And he was saying that is a waste of your money, and you'd be better off putting that money into a really good preschool, because that's where your child is learning how to learn. If your child is in this environment where they're constantly engaged and they're building their foundations for learning, by the time they get to high school, children who were not able to do that, who were not put in an environment where here's all these stimulating, interesting materials, and you have the freedom to be creative, you have the freedom to choose what you want to do. If you fail, something simple, let's say building a castle out of blocks. If you fail, you learn when it falls down, well, what went wrong? How do I fix it next time? How do I add more materials? How do I do all these things? This builds up creativity, it builds up resilience, and these are the things you will need when you're an adult and you start a project.
Welcome to Humanly, podcast about the extraordinary ideas and ordinary people. Stories that we tell ourselves to make sense of the world around us. Isn't that precisely what makes us human? My name is Paula and I'm a Renaissance soul. I'm passionate about concepts, but most importantly, how they evolve when shared with other people. You'll hear about what I learn daily through books, people, experiences, in a series of solo episodes and interviews. Welcome on board. Glad to have you here, fellow human. Hello, creators. Welcome to the newest episode of Humanly. Today, we're going to talk about something that I was curious about, things that I would like to hear as a child. So we're going to talk about how to develop and nurture your authentic personality when raising your child. Let me introduce today's guest, Elia, who's the early child development teacher and after hours meme queen with great sarcastic flair. Elia, how are you doing today?
Hi, Paula. Thanks for having me. I'm doing good today. A little bit nervous to be on your podcast.
I'm really curious because you've been living here in Tokyo for the past 3 years. You work with really small children. I'm really curious about your own childhood. What were you like as a child? What's your favorite memory?
My childhood, I grew up in a home where quite traditional. My father went to work and he was the breadwinner, and my mother was a housewife. I have 3 siblings. 2 of them are much older than I am. In terms of what I was like as a child, from my memories, I was quite well behaved, especially at school. Like, I was always the child that the teacher would leave in charge of the class when she had to go to the bathroom or something like that. Like, I was responsible and, yeah, always concerned about not wanting to get in trouble. I don't know if I was so much like that at home. I think I was, but at the same time, I had this curiosity and cleverness. I like to find things out for myself. Like, for example, when I found out that Santa Claus was not real, this is not something that anyone was telling me, but I kept pushing and pushing and asking questions that were being ignored or pushed to the side. And I was like, no, this doesn't add up. And I went searching because in my house, Santa Claus would come on Christmas Eve with the sack of presents. And it was always a family member, like an uncle, dressed up as Santa Claus. And we'd, you know, say, oh, Santa's here. We'd see him waving. And then he'd come in the house and hand out all these gifts. And at some point, I started to recognize, like, there's some familiarity with the face and the voice, even though they tried to, you know, disguise the voice. And some things just were not making sense to me. And so I started to snoop around the house. And I found all the material. The bag, the beard, the costume downstairs in the cellar, or in Italian we call it the cantina. Uh-huh. And this was hiding somewhere in there with all the Christmas stuff. And so I asked a few more questions first, I guess, to see if anyone would be honest with me, and they were not. So one day I put everything on, even though it's a full man, grown man's costume. I put everything on, like with the pillow inside as well. And I went upstairs with the sack, like, ho, 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 like to show everyone, like, you think I'm stupid? So maybe they didn't think my behavior was good in that particular moment, but things like that, I think I had this cleverness and curiosity, and I wanted to find things out for myself. My favorite memories as a child, I think they would be doing very hands-on things that mattered. Like, for example, my dad is a handyman, so if he was cleaning the roof, he would let me come up to the roof with him. Maybe I wasn't doing so much work, but it still makes you feel important, like you're contributing and that, you know, your parents believe in you, that you can do things that matter, things that contribute to society, not just, you know, sit down and draw this picture or, you know, sit down and play with this toy. I think children can recognize the difference when you let them know that they are capable.
Wow. I mean, I envy you to some extent. I can definitely see adult grown-up Elia in the Santa Claus story, like this whole investigation and not buying the bullshit. So that's quite hilarious. But also what you say about your parents involving you in household chores and trusting that you, not maybe counting on you fulfilling the task perfectly, but still including you regardless, is something extraordinary, because my mom was the exact opposite. And I think lots of parents, they fear for their kids because they think, oh, they'll harm themselves, or oh, I'll have to clean after them. They protect their children to some extent, but they also like think, oh, there'll be a time they'll learn it. Great segue to talk about child psychology in general term. What made you interested in that in the first place, and what's your favorite thing about being a teacher?
I was one of those children that when they ask you in kindergarten, what do you want to be when you grow up? I used to always say, a teacher, a teacher, a teacher. And that just kind of stuck with me. I'm not sure why. But even like growing up in elementary school, I kind of always had that interest, because even when I was quite young, I started reading and writing quite early. So when I was in the class and I, you know, could do the work that some of the children weren't able to do yet, the teacher would ask me to help them. And then, you know, by like seventh or eighth grade, when there's like English as a second language students and they would all gather, sometimes they would send me to work with them and to help them. And I think that continued to build my self-esteem and my idea that, oh, wow, I can, you know, teach and I can help. So, yeah, this was always a goal in my mind. And at some point when you have to start deciding what will I do with my life, it became something that I needed to work towards. So when I was in university and the plan shifted a bit as life happens, but I always just said, I want to be a teacher. Then when you learn the process, you learn, you know, you kind of have to specify elementary school children. Because in Canada, if you go to teacher's college, you need to choose, you know, if you have one teachable subject, two teachable subjects, math, English, whatever it may be. And however many you have, that changes the grade level that you can teach. So originally, I thought this is what I wanted. Then in high school, I did some peer mentoring with some of the students who had special needs. This was very special to me, and I really enjoyed it. And then I decided I want to have my own special needs classroom. Then I learned the process of what I have to do for that. And then somewhere I started to take some specialized courses. Then after I finished my university, after your postgrad would be your teacher's college in Canada. So when I was going to do that, I decided I want to take 1 year off in the middle. And then I learned that you can study early childhood. And because I already had a university degree, I could do this 2-year program in 1 year, like fast track. And I was like, why not take that year and do that? That way I'm certified from birth to whatever age. But then I loved that. So now I don't want to go up and teach older kids now. That is where I will stay with younger children. Definitely early childhood. And I noticed when I was in the early childhood program, they were saying that people who were coming from teacher's college, and they were saying the way that you've been taught how to teach, if you're going to be here and learn how to teach small children, it's going to be hard for you, but you need to unlearn everything you know, because it's completely different. It's not sitting down pen to paper. You instruct them and tell them what to do and they learn it. And I think when you've been trained so hard to teach that way, it was hard for some people. I mean, I wasn't coming from that environment because I had just done an arts degree. It wasn't related to teaching yet, but that was one interesting thing to me. And then for me, learning this way first and learning the child actual brain development behind it all, I was like, but this makes sense. So why would people do it any other way when this is the way that makes sense? This is where the research is. Yeah, I continued on that way. When I finished my early childhood diploma, I was able to go to China for like an internship for 2 weeks. And when I was there, I really enjoyed it. And they offered me a job. And then I stayed there 2 years. And then I was ready for a change. And I moved to Japan. And now I've been here 3 years. And yeah, life just happens and your plans change. But for now, I'm quite happy here. I kind of always knew what I wanted. It just, plans kind of changed along the way.
I mean, it's quite exciting story. And your passion for it really comes through. We have teachers that are passionate about what they're doing. They're bad teachers. But I guess the stereotype around early childhood and like teaching is that you don't get to do much, right? That it's more about babysitting than actually teaching, changing diapers, okay, dealing with difficult children who go into tantrums. If you put it this way, what kind of mission I can have there, right? But what you're talking about now, this is the most vulnerable period of humans' life, where your personality is being shaped, when you're actually learning how to exist in social structures. So being an early development teacher, it puts a lot of responsibility on your shoulders because you're actually contributing to how these kids are going to end up as adults. We really have to normalize the fact that this is very important foundational work.
Add to that, they say that the first 5 to 7 years of your life are the most important. That's when your brain is developing the fastest. And that kind of sets you up for the rest of your adult life. I did some professional development recently. He's an instructor and he also has studied linguistics, psychology. He has tons of degrees. He has ADHD, so he says he can't focus himself. He had some very interesting things to say because he's able to contribute from so many different perspectives. And from what he was saying about the first bit of your life that's so important, and he was saying that often when parents are thinking about like where they're going to put their money, like if they have a child and they're thinking, let's save all this money to put them in a really good private high school. And he was saying that is a waste of your money and you'd be better off putting that money into a really good preschool because that's where your child is learning how to learn. If your child is in this environment where they're constantly engaged and they're building their foundations for learning, by the time they get to high school, children who were not able to do that, who were not put in an environment where here's all these stimulating, interesting materials, and you have the freedom to be creative, you have the freedom to choose what you want to do. If you fail, something simple, let's say building a castle out of blocks. If you fail, you learn when it falls down, well, what went wrong? How do I fix it next time? How do I add more materials? How do I do all these things? This builds up creativity. It builds up resilience. And these are the things you will need when you're an adult and you start a project. You're comfortable with failing. You're comfortable with struggling. These are things that you've learned from your childhood and that you've developed a propensity to work through. So that was really interesting that he had that to say about putting money into early childhood as opposed to high school.
Wow. Yeah, that completely flipped my perspective too, because probably I would be one of those people betting my money on, or maybe even college. I was just like, yeah, go through the whole like public schooling and then we'll send you to a good school. But you're right. When I think about Polish education, I've attended quite good schools. Yeah, it's more about learning for the test than actually learning critical thinking or learning thinking outside of your box or being able to debate or, you know, enter the discussion and introduce your point of view. You mentioned it to some extent talking about this New Zealand trainer, but I'm really curious about your teaching method of your school because it's quite different from the usual. So if you could maybe talk about that a bit more and what are the benefits of that?
From an early childhood standpoint, for the most part, most early childhood programs, they understand child development and they value this different way. It's more when you get to elementary school that this shift happens, this formal schooling, pen to paper, you sit down, the instructor teaches you something, you memorize it, you regurgitate it back in a test or something. And I'm sure from some people can learn this way, but I'm sure from most people's experience, this has no value to you. This is not something that you retain. It's not something that's important to you. If you even think yourself of the most valuable learning experiences in your life, I'm sure they did not happen from that sort of formal schooling experience. And I mean, from all the information we have, and we know that that doesn't work for people, it's crazy that this still goes on. But I mean, in early childhood setting, it's play-based, child-led, and in some settings, like the one I work in, it's project-based. So what that means is curriculum is not preset. Curriculum depends on the children, the group of children, what they're interested in. So your curriculum is made through making observations, observing the children's interests, and whatever they're showing interest in, you continue to provide those materials for them. You make sure that they're at this important difficulty level where it's not too difficult for them, that they'll be too frustrated. It's not too easy for them, that they are not engaged. So from the teacher's point of view, it's a lot of observations. The children, this is their world, this is their space, and you are providing for them what they need to continue to learn, but it's based on what they're interested in. I work with quite young children, like 2.5 to 3.5. And I mean, sometimes their interests are fleeting. They come and go. You start something and you can keep it up for a few weeks and then it fades away. But I've had some also good experiences, the young children that went on for a year, which was I felt very proud of myself because it was my first experience trying to run a project. And I was quite intimidated by the thought of doing something for a whole year. But you see it a lot more in like the 4 and 5 year olds. Like, for example, they're interested one time before I got there, I just saw this project book that they had made in wedding dresses. So they began going around Roppongi and visiting specialty shops, drawing pictures of the dresses, interviewing people who make the dresses, starting to get their sketchbooks out, draw their own dresses. And then they needed to think about, how are we going to make a dress? Because their ultimate goal was to make dresses and have a fashion show. And of course, I mean, I wouldn't know how to make a dress even if I tried, right? So, you know, these kids had to think about that and then maybe think, well, what materials can we use? Well, let's try newspaper. Oh, wait, the newspaper rips, back to the drawing board. And they work and work and work at problem solving. And I think in those situations, the teacher needs to put some effort into keeping them focused because sometimes they might become frustrated because they're not figuring it out. But yeah, the teacher encourages them to press on. And through this, you're not sitting them down and saying, you have to learn your ABCs. You have to prove to me that you know this. This is not helpful learning to anyone. But through this, they're learning measurements. They're learning the alphabet. They're trying to write and make notes. And they're learning all these literacy, numeracy, science skills. And ultimately, they're learning, more importantly than those things, things that are more important later in life, soft skills like their social skills, their ability to cooperate with other children, negotiate. And these things are extremely important. When it's something meaningful to children, the same way as it goes with adults, you are interested. So you retain that stuff. You put more effort into it because it's something that you're genuinely interested in learning more about and a goal that you're working towards. As an adult, you do it because you know you have to, but the whole time you're like, oh, I know how to sit through this. I know how to make it look like I'm paying attention, but you're not really paying attention. You're not really retaining any information.
I'm 30 years old now and I don't imagine that I could know how to sew the wedding dress. So kudos to these kids. I guess when I think about my own formalized schooling experience, I remember very vividly when I was told that I did things the wrong way, and it was actually arts class, right? So I was so excited because I was into, you know, watercolor and about like drawing. So I just decided to draw a portrait of like dog family. And I remember I was so proud of the final outcome, and I couldn't wait for the teacher to see it. And I remember how she broke my spirit saying, oh, looks good, but work on your perspective, you know? And I'm like, this little comment completely like broke my enthusiasm. I'm like, oh, so I'm doing it wrong. So there's actually a set of rules to do that. I actually reclaimed my creativity and playfulness when I became an adult, when I actually discovered how important this is to me and how my voice, creative voice, was in a way silenced by being in this confined and restrained environment. I guess it's just really important to nurture this feeling of there's no right or wrong. It's not important how you get to the final outcome. It's just important you get there. When you think about the exams you're studying for, you usually study for the test. So you're learning the way or the structures that work according to the key, exactly to get the mark that you want. So you're not really learning how to creatively think about the problem that makes sense to you. So what you're talking about really makes a lot of sense for me. In terms of, because I think a lot of parents listening to what we're talking about now, they're like, okay, part of the deal would be make sure that I'm sending my kids to the right preschool. Can they actually nurture the environment themselves at home, spending time or relating to the child? So if you had, you know, some tips on how to free these kids from social conditioning, you know, and make sure that they're the best version of themselves, what would you advise them to do?
So from my perspective, inviting, let's say, a new child into my classroom, obviously the first little bit, it's a new environment, new adults, new people. Emotionally, it's stressful for them. First and foremost, children's relationships with adults are the most important. As long as you have a caring, loving, trusting relationship, children will let their guard down and they're free to learn things. So that's obviously the most important thing. I would also say letting the children lead. I see a lot of people, like the children will sit and draw a picture or pretend to cook something and people automatically go and, what are you doing? What is that? Their intentions are good, but most of the time they're interrupting the children. They're interrupting their train of thought, their creativity. And also, if you think about it from your own perspective, if you were drawing a picture of a bear and I came to you and I said, oh, what is that? How would that make you feel? Obviously, you know, that would make you feel like, what do you mean? Of course it's a bear. And this can cause stress. Recently did a webinar, like a parent workshop on this, the importance of open-ended questions and how to ask powerful questions. And a lot of parents had these questions, like, how do I engage with my child when they're playing? And I mean, something as simple as kind of narrating, the way they say it in early childhood is like, you are a sportscaster for your child. So to describe what they're doing back to them, it's also good for their language development. So you see this, what looks to you like scribbles on paper, and it's helpful to say, wow, I really like what you're drawing. I see you used lots of red and lots of purple and you made lines and squiggles and dots. That's enough. You're so creative. Add some sort of compliment that's genuine, because, wow, good job. Good job can be taken away 5 minutes later by bad job. You know what I mean? But if you tell someone you're strong, you're creative, these sort of words of affirmation, people hold on to those. And you can't take that away from people. So these things are very important. It's also very important to let children struggle and to let them fail. And this is very hard for some parents to do. As soon as they see their child, let's say, putting on their own shoes, learning how to do that for the first time, and they can't do it and they're struggling, parents often automatically feel overwhelmed by their children's emotions. They don't want them to feel that way. So they will go and put their shoes on for them. And this is oftentimes not helpful because, you know, this builds resilience and this helps children learn how to problem solve. Obviously, you need to be aware of what level they're at. Like, you wouldn't ask a small child, put your shoes on, when you know they have no idea how to. But if you know they're almost ready, it's enough to be there with them, supporting them. That looks tricky, but I think you can do it. Why don't you try to be as hands-off as possible, but guide them through it and let them know that you are always there for them. And this idea of always being there for them and being open to their struggles and their emotions, this has a lot to do with tantrums and meltdowns as well with small children. I think I was speaking to you about this earlier, actually. You see a lot of parents, when their children are throwing a tantrum, they automatically think how, or they ask, how do I console my child? How do I make them feel better? Sometimes the answer is you can't. Children's frontal cortex is not developed yet. So their ability to make decisions is much smaller than their impulse. They don't have an impulse control yet. Sometimes those impulses are emotions. So sometimes, you know, they don't get what they want. Let's say they want a cookie and they can't have it and they have a meltdown. It's important that you have clear, consistent boundaries with children. You can't have this cookie because you haven't eaten dinner or whatever it may be. And it's important that once you make the boundary, you stick to it and you follow through. But when your child's having a meltdown like that, it's also important that you acknowledge their feelings. And sometimes this can be enough. What children at that age want most, I mean, what everybody wants, is to feel heard and to feel seen. And oftentimes a lot of parents will say, like, I'm cold, I'm hungry. No, you're not. No, you're not. This is really problematic to tell somebody you don't know how your own body feels. You don't know when you're hungry. You don't know when you're tired. It's a bit insulting to people's intelligence, even children. And at the end of the day, you should be try to treat them with the same respect that you would treat other adults. Back to this meltdown idea or a tantrum, your role is not to console or make it stop. Your role is to let your child know this is a safe space for you to work through this emotion that you have. Because at the end of the day, this emotion is happening. And the only way to heal from an emotion is to work through it. So to let them know, you look really frustrated right now. You really wanted to eat that cookie. You don't have to give the cookie, but you need to acknowledge how they feel. And sometimes this is enough because they see this person that I trust understands where I'm coming from, and then they can slowly come down from it.
I love it. I really love it. We have access to a lot of information and lots of schools with alternative schooling methods that, and maybe with teachers that are educated on the aspects that you mentioned. When I think about my own childhood, I think emotions was a big deal. Not being sure about what I feel and what my needs are, because yeah, I was in a house with lots of siblings and I was the one who was supposed to be responsible. So I was in a way restraining my own feelings and my needs in favor of the little ones, because I was there to be responsible and caring. As an adult, I really found it hard to take care of my own needs or to talk about my needs, or I felt bad, feeling bad emotions because I couldn't express them. I think the social conditioning is that there's either a bad emotion or a good emotion. You're only entitled to express the good emotion. But this is a completely, I think, wrong concept here, that emotion is an emotion. You have to like work through it because it's just part of the experience of being human. So you stressing it and really letting children know from the very young age that it's okay, that you can like really familiarize yourself with the whole array of emotions, is really, really important, especially for high sensitive kids.
Yeah, to add to that, I just want to say that the environment that I create in my classroom, I always strive to make an environment where all emotions are valid and all emotions are welcome and you're free to express them, obviously within limit. You can't be angry and hurting other people or breaking things. There are boundaries, but your emotions, everyone's emotions, all of them are completely valid and welcomed and accepted in that space.
Obviously, like there's a different parenting styles out there. There are parents who probably want to protect their kids. They want to make sure they're safe. So especially when they're that young and when you're saying they can't really control their impulses. I wonder what's the balance here to let the child have a right to decide and create these boundaries, but also create some sort of discipline, right? So that the child learns, you know, it's not all about you.
So just last week, I had parent-teacher conferences in my classroom, and the children in my class are about 2.5. So I'd say I had 11 conferences. And obviously this question came up in every conference because this is the way children this age are behaving and the struggles that they're having. So I find in the past week or so, it's something that I always deal with on a daily basis because I work with children that age, but it's always helpful to read about it more. And I've also been reading a lot about this in the past couple weeks. When it comes to setting boundaries, the most important thing is that the boundaries are clear and consistent. Consistency is very important. Because small children, when their frontal cortex is not yet completely developed, the same way they explore everything in the world, they're starting from zero. So everything about the world, they are learning through experience. So if you notice, small children will like toys where they press a button and the same thing happens. This cause and effect, consistency. I press the green button and it moves like a cow. I press this button, it opens a box. They will do these things over and over and over and over because they're starting to understand this schema. I do this and this happens. And then they need to do this with other people as well and with their parents. And sometimes when a child pushes a boundary, like let's say they keep slamming a door and they're, you know, playing with this door over and over and over, and you're trying to explain to them, it's dangerous, you can get your fingers caught, it can hit somebody on the other side of the door, and they just keep doing it. A lot of parents will be like, well, I don't know what to do. They won't stop. And I think there's this confusion between a rule and a boundary. A rule is saying you can't play with that door. A boundary is saying I'm going to stop you from playing with the door, and it's perfectly okay to do that. If they can't stop on their own, to remove their hand, I'm going to help you and move them away from the door. And chances are, not intentionally, this is just the way their brains work. They're trying to understand how things work. So if you stop me from doing it, my brain will automatically go, oh, she stopped me. Let's see if it happens again. And I think sometimes we look at the children and we're like, oh, they're being so naughty. They know I want them to stop and they won't. Most of the time when they're really little, that is not actually their intention. That's their impulse to understand what happens in the situation, where the boundary is. So a lot of parents complain that, you know, I keep telling them to stop and they won't. But then when you watch them, they tell them to stop, but nothing really comes of it. They let them continue. And to the child, that's confusing. You tell me to, your words are telling me to stop, but you're not actually showing me what happens when I stop. So yeah, so for children that age, they will continue to push the same boundary until it's clear and consistent what happens. Like, I will not accept you slamming this door. I mean, if you consistently tell a child and you use too many words, like let's say more than two sentences, you shouldn't do that, on and on and on. They can't hear you much after that. And you also run the risk of creating this narrative that I'm a naughty child. So you're creating this idea in their head is like, I'm the naughty child. I'm the one who draws on the walls and slams doors. Every time they see a wall and a crayon, they're going to do it because you've created this narrative of that's who you are, as opposed to creating this narrative that if I try to draw on the wall, somebody stops me every time, every time, every time. It's clear I can't draw on the wall, but they will keep pushing the boundary because sometimes your reaction is different every time. And some people think, I just have to show them that I'm really mad. And to be honest with you, to show a small child that you're very mad, they're like, wow, what button did I push to get this big reaction? And that's so entertaining to them. That's exciting for them. You need to set your boundary, and you really always need to seem like you are unbothered and unfazed. And if you take their crayon away and they start to throw a tantrum, the boundary does not change. You still need to be consistent. And in that moment, they're testing, like I said before, not on purpose, not because they're malicious and they were trying to bother you. Children don't intentionally want to bother their caregivers or annoy them. That's just the limit that they're exploring. And sometimes parents are like, oh, but they can't handle that I took this crayon from them. And it's actually the complete opposite. They're now in this state of chaos and they're feeling like, I have too much control. I have too much power here. Who's going to take it from me? And they're looking for a clear, capable leader. And when you're not in control of yourself, you don't seem unbothered. You know, you seem like, oh, you're giving in to them. That's not clear, consistent leadership. And that confuses them a lot. And it can be quite difficult for them to recover because they don't really know where they stand. And now they have to do the same thing over and over until they figure out where you stand. Like, what if I do this tomorrow, or when she's tired, or when I'm hungry, or on a Tuesday? They will try it all the different ways until they know, like, this is the way this goes.
Wow, I'm learning so much with you here, because I would be this parent who think, oh, I cannot interfere with what they're doing. I have to teach them discipline by simply telling them to stop. So I guess, this is something mind-blowing to maybe understand, that they're not operating at the same brain level as we are. So it's not about their bad intention. It's just about them exploring the world. It's part of the exploration. I guess it's also important that you don't treat it personally.
In terms of when parents ask, like, what should the consequence be to their actions or the punishment, there's like a clear distinction between a punishment and a consequence, like a natural consequence. Oftentimes you see parents saying, like, don't do that. Stop doing that. Okay, you won't stop doing that. You can't go to your friend's birthday party on Saturday. And taking something away from the child that's important to them, just because you know it's going to hurt them, doesn't teach them any sort of lesson. And most of the time, these children will do what you want just to get back the thing that you took from them. And they haven't really learned anything, as opposed to a natural consequence. As opposed to a natural consequence where, you know, constantly getting up from the table and you're trying to teach them, like, when you're eating, you sit down. And then, you know, you're telling them, you're showing me that you don't want to eat anymore, so I will put your food away. And, you know, clean up the food and put it away. That's a natural consequence. You're showing you don't want to eat, the food goes away. You're banging your fork on the table, you know, you're showing me you don't want to eat with a fork, I can put the fork away. You can find another way to eat. These are like natural consequences to your actions. A punishment is not related to what the child has done, so they can't make this connection. And when they think of that situation at another time, they don't think, oh, that time that I drew on the wall, or that time I did something that my mom didn't like, I really shouldn't have done that. What they remember is, remember when my mom took that thing from me? Remember when she made me stand in the corner? They feel shame, they feel resentment. And these are really not good feelings to make children feel, when you could have done it another way that maybe is a little bit trickier as a parent. But once you establish that relationship with your child, it does become a bit easier. And this is a situation where they naturally learned what the consequence is to not do it again, because that's just the natural flow of events. And those two things are very different.
This is really great. I hope I'll apply that one day. when I have my own kids. But yeah, this is a fundamental difference, like punishment and the consequence, because I think it's just in these tricky situations when the child is misbehaving, I think parents, they feel like they're failing, and they feel maybe if they have their own issues from their own childhood, they feel, oh, this child doesn't, I don't know, respect me. So they take it on a very personal level. I'll hurt them the way they hurt me, because they feel hurt. They feel like, oh, this kid. So the consequence would be a more neutral approach here to make sure that the child learns.
On this topic of respecting them as individuals, I think this happens a lot, that people forget that they are people too. Not just, oh, that's just a kid. Some things that I try to continuously do in my practice, like for example, with touching, touch small children. If I need to check their diaper, I tell them, can I touch your diaper? Like, ask permission to touch people, because with an adult, you wouldn't just touch someone. You would make sure you have their consent before you touch them. And it also teaches them that they have their own body autonomy and that they should respect other people and not put their hands on them. And I mean, some other examples of that, I've always thought it was very funny when, you know, children are playing with things and they can't share, or they're fighting over something, and adults tell them, you can use that for 5 more minutes. And this doesn't make any sense. You don't know what they're doing. They're small children. So they could be in the middle of doing something important. And when your arbitrary 5 minutes ends, they could be, you know, in the middle of something so important to them. And you're like, no, your 5 minutes is done. And if you change this to an adult situation, if I told you, can I borrow your computer? I wouldn't be like, you have 45 more seconds, then I'm taking it, right? It'd be like, oh, I'm just writing this email. When I'm finished, I'll give you my computer. So I always do the same thing with them. Like, when you're finished, this person's waiting to use it. And I think a lot of people think, oh, but they're children. They're not capable of finishing what they're doing and then remembering that someone else needs it, but they are. This environment where you encourage this, that they begin to do this on their own. Even if they can't speak, sometimes I see the motion, like if it's a car, like around in a circle with their hand, and they're saying like, I'll take it around one time and then I'll give it to you. And they do it. Maybe not the first or second time, it's hard for them to give up what they want. But after, you know, a few weeks of this, they can do it on their own independently. Another example, if let's say I asked you, Paula, can I borrow your car? And every time I borrow your car, I give it back to you with no gas in it. The natural consequence would not be like, I'm not inviting Elia to my birthday party, or I know Elia really likes gin, so next time I go to a gin bar, I'm not inviting her, because those things have nothing to do with each other. The consequence would be, naturally, I'm not going to let Elia borrow my car anymore. You don't respect me enough to put gas in it when you give it back. And it's the same thing, and it's really helpful sometimes to try to think of the situation between adults and think, why do I expect that to apply to children? And how do I expect them to build the skills to exist in the world when they're older if I'm not setting them up for that? I'm setting them up for situations that won't exist when they grow up.
Intuitive attitude would be to try to shield their children from all the bad in the world, from the bad news, or from like topics like death. If something bad happens in the family, they try to maybe hide it from a child, or come up with alternative story, or even the Santa Claus white lie. But I just wonder if there's a better way to go around that, and when is a good time to introduce kids to these concepts? Because even for me, with the Santa Claus, I had a similar encounter. I was really excited about like the whole concept of a Santa, but then at school when I was 7, some boy actually ridiculed me for not knowing Santa is not real. So I really felt deceived. And I was 7, and I was like, yeah, I would prefer to know, you know, that this is the case. So I wonder, how do we tell the kids the bad news, and what's the good way, and when is the right time to start doing it?
Yeah, I think that's quite complicated, but your example of life and death, and, you know, explain to children what death means. I mean, I don't think that for any child you would just have to sit them down, unless there's a death in the family or something like that, that it's come up now and you have to deal with it. But I notice some children will notice something, and then they will start to ask questions. And when they start to ask questions and they have this curiosity, I think you should be answering their questions. Not in a way that's going to scare them. It should be age appropriate. My personal opinion is that you shouldn't be lying to children. Like, sometimes you see parents coming in and they think their child can't deal with the separation. So they will tell the child like, oh, go play with that. And then when they think their child's distracted, they will run out the door. And this is so awful, because it creates more separation anxiety, because like I said before, the bond and the trust that you have with your child is so important. And when you deceive them that way, they don't just think, oh, she left me in this place. They think, every time I let my guard down and turn my back, my mother could disappear. So then you see children start having separation anxiety in public. They can't go play in the park because they think, if I turn around, my mother can leave, because that's what she does. Being honest about things that relate to the child and things that are important to their life, I think you always should be honest with them. And like another example, sometimes I hear parents saying, like, their child says, I don't want to stay here. And we always try to explain to them their routine. This is your school life. This is your routine. So your mom will come back at 2 o'clock. Every day she comes back at 2 o'clock. So they can start to build this self-regulation skill that they know what their day is like. And then if they're crying, some parents will say, don't worry, I'll come back at 1 o'clock. When they're not coming at 1 o'clock. And I always tell the children, I think she made a mistake. She's coming back at 2 o'clock. Like, it's not fair to lie to them that way when it relates to them. Or mom picks up and the child says, I want my dad to pick me up, and they don't want to leave. And they lie and say, he's just outside, to get them out the door. I think that this is not good to do these sorts of things to children. And if they start asking questions about life and death, it's a good opportunity. Like, this happened at school a few years ago. They started to run a project in the 3 to 4 year old class on life cycles. So they started to bring in their own baby pictures of their family, and talk about life cycles. And obviously that ends in death. But if they start to have questions about it, you can't pretend it's not happening. You have to find a way. It's tricky sometimes, and each child will be different and each child will take it differently. But ultimately, you know your child, and you can kind of understand what they can handle and find a way to explain it. But I don't think lying is ever really the right answer.
The example that you brought up about leaving your kid at the nursery and pretending go play and then disappearing, this is a form of like escapism and maybe like a safe way out for a parent. In this case, I guess they should make sure that the child is comfortable, maybe in a way that, yeah, they have this trust-based relationship that they really can rely on their word. I don't have kids, but I have friends with kids, and I hear them saying that, or I have my own experiences having lots of siblings. When you're the only child or the first child, you're probably in the center of attention. You're maybe still learning how to be parents, so they're very careful. But then, let's say a few years later, another sibling, another child appears, right? So this might create a sense of like jealousy and anxiety and feeling of maybe even separateness from the parent. And I guess in a way, parents favorite some kid to another, but maybe this, like in my understanding, stems more from the fact that this parent maybe identify himself or herself with this child's character, so he can maybe bond easier with this child. So it's not they love their children equally, but maybe because of the fact that the child resembled themselves, it's easier for them to create this bond. So I just wonder, what do you think about this, like, siblings rivalry? What would be the right way for the parent to make sure that both children feel important?
I think that within any group of siblings, whether there's two or more, there will always be some sort of rivalry, of course, especially when the children are younger. I think of myself as a child. I used to fight with my sister so much, like physically, fist fighting. Same. And I know a lot of children at that, like when they're younger, they have the same experience. But now that you grow up, as you grow up, the age difference doesn't mean so much. Like my siblings, some are much older than me. Then my youngest sister, she's only 2 years apart from me. And when we were kids, it was completely different. Like, it's unrelatable. But now that we're older, we can all hang out. And when children are younger, yeah, there's always some sense of rivalry and maybe competition for parents' attention. And this is a complicated question to answer because I think it depends on each individual child and their needs. Like, maybe parents will give more attention to one child, but it could just be that that child needs more from them in that moment. And another child that they have might interpret that as favoritism when maybe it's not. Like, I don't know if you watch the show This Is Us. This family, when you see it from everyone's individual perspective, they can look at the exact same situation in so many different ways. Like in the show, it seems that the mother and the father do everything they can to give the children the best life. But then when you look at it from one child's perspective, he felt like an outsider. And then the other two children feel like, oh, actually he was favorited, but that's because the mother just thought he needed more because he felt like an outsider. I think sometimes some of that goes on as well, that everyone has their own interpretation of events. In the example that a new child is born into a family, that's always complicated or tricky for the other child. I remember myself as a child, I was about 2.5 when my sister was born. And up until then, I was the youngest one in the family because, you know, I have older siblings. So my older cousins were similar in age to them. So I was the only little one at the time. She came along and it went from everyone always coming over to visit me and to see me and to talk about how cute I am. Now there's this new baby and I was still there, obviously, but I felt like they were coming to see her and she was taking that attention from me. So one time I took the newborn baby, I was only 2.5, and I went like in a corner between two cabinets and I just put her there on the floor and I got in her baby carrier with her soother and her hat and I covered myself in the blanket. So when they went, "Ooh, the baby," I was there like, "Yeah, here I am." And there everyone was freaking out like, "Where is the baby? You can't lift a newborn baby." And I just hid her like beside a cabinet somewhere because I wanted my attention back. So I think a lot of children struggle to feel that they're not getting enough attention when a new child is born, and parents have to do a lot of things to validate and let them understand that they are still their child and they are still important. And I mean, some of those things can be making sure there's family time, there's time for just one parent and both children together there, and there's also just time for the one parent one-on-one doing activity so they understand that that bond and that relationship still exists between them and their one parent or their two parents or whatever the family structure is. There will always be negative emotions or feelings. It's not like, "Oh no, you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't say that. You have to love your sister. That's your sister. That's your brother." They also need their space to let out their negative emotions because they have them. So to create the safe space and not invalidate their emotions by telling them, "No, you shouldn't think that way. You shouldn't feel that way." When does it ever work to tell someone you shouldn't feel that way? It doesn't. And the same applies to children.
There's no right or wrong answer to it. What you suggested for parents to have one-on-one and create this scenario when they have time for the kids separately, maybe might confirm their... But they're also important.
I think this is something that we rarely take into account, that we're dealing with people who have their own wants, needs. And I really love what you said about touching, because I think maybe our generation, again, our parents didn't have access to the information, and maybe also the research wasn't that advanced. But I remember clear as day, especially girls, they were like, "Oh, give a hug to an uncle. Give a kiss to your aunt. Oh, why are you crying? Your aunt is here. Go say hi. Go smile." So this is really impeding on children's boundaries. And you're teaching them, yeah, their emotions are not important. In the most like perverse scenarios, this may lead to these kids agreeing to something they don't want to be part of. It was a really enlightening conversation. Again, I don't have kids and I don't interact with kids on a daily basis, but I was really inspired by all your stories that you bring from your from your school and all the techniques and methods that really nurture authenticity, nurture creativity and self-expression that is so, so lacking in today's society. So I'm glad we had a chance to talk about that. The last question, the takeaway maybe for our listeners is probably parents, like new parents, are overwhelmed with having a kid. They have to learn everything from scratch. So if you wanted to give them one simple advice to follow, what would that be?
I mean, I think for me, I've always been a very, like you said, highly sensitive. I'm the same. You know, from my perspective, letting emotions run free and, you know, validating children's emotions always makes a huge difference. I mean, even when I have new children in my classroom, even just to tell them when they're struggling and crying, "What can we do?" And I'm like, "You know, it's okay. It's going to be okay." And I always tell the children, "It's okay if you want to cry here. You're free to cry here. Whatever you need, you tell me. If you need a hug, whatever you need, tell me what you need." And I think this is really important in creating a culture of empathetic people who are respectful of other people's emotions and who are able to recognize and express their own emotions. Because I think in my childhood, I don't feel I was free to do that.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful message at the end. It would have made a fundamental change in how I perceived myself if I knew it's okay to feel bad emotions. It's okay to be sensitive and to filter the world through different lenses than everyone else. I'll just feel less alone, that it's okay. Yeah, great message. So Elia, thank you so much for taking the time to have with me this conversation. I really had lots of takeaways, and I think so did my listeners. Thank you again. And I hope to see you maybe in the next episode. Who knows?
Bye, Paula. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. And see you in the next episode. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in. Hopefully, something piqued your interest in today's episode and maybe stirred a bit of flow in your life. If you wanted to share your experiences or simply say hi, feel free to send me a message via email, humanly.space@gmail.com, or just drop by to my Instagram account, humanly.space, that I'll be sharing in my show notes. Keep flowing! See you next episode.